Yeah, I'm going to do my second talk of the day and annoy you with kind of the continuation with what I talked about earlier today. So Linux and TPMs. Yeah, I hope the overlap's not going to be too big. If you have any specific questions, again, do interrupt me. I like very much if we can get the discussion into the direction that you want rather than me just read what I have on my slides here. Anyway, so let's jump right in. I'm going to talk about the work in adding TPM support to systemd and my goal of actually making this a thing on across the Linux ecosystem and making this a thing that hopefully all the Linux distributions can sooner or later just adopt. And yeah, so my goals are, I want to catch up with other OSs. Like most other OSs, like if you look at Android, if you look at Apple devices and Windows, since 10 years or something, have been using TPMs heavily, have had measured boot, have used disk encryption locked to these TPMs or equivalent secure elements. Generic Linux just didn't, right? Like Chrome OS had, but like if you install one of the classic Linux distributions, none of them use any of this. The TPM stuff basically doesn't really exist outside of like commercial OSs. So my goal with this is, yeah, I want this to change. I think that the functionality offered by measured boot is great, and we should make it a thing that everybody can just use, and thus build a world that is more secure and less vulnerable to hackers and things like that. So. Yeah, one of the primary goals of the TPM stuff is always disk encryption, meaning that you can store or associate a secret that unlocks your disk in the TPM, and then the TPM can enforce policies on how it allows access to that key. The interesting parts is like specifically how these policies are designed. I talked about this earlier, about the PCR concept that we have on Linux and measurements and things like that. So this kind of stuff. But we want to use it for more than disk encryption. I also want to use it for service credentials. I mentioned this earlier. I think some talks even mentioned this earlier. The concept of service credentials in systemd is something like how you can securely parameterize services with things like SSL certificates, private keys, passwords, or actually any kind of configuration too, if that's what you want. But the primary goal is having something that it can be encrypted, can be authenticated, and can be passed into services in a reasonably safe way, and then is available for the services to read. I wanted this to be linked to TPM as well, so that these secrets can only be unlocked on a specific system, so that it can feel reasonably safe that if you put a secret on some system, that it's only that system and in the right state can decode this. Pretty closely related to this is also secure parameterization of the boot process, because in the general case, booting a system means that you have to parameterize it somehow. Like it could be something simple as like you boot from the network and you want to specify the server, and then you want to pin this certificate inside of that thing. So these parameters somehow need to get onto that system and be authenticated, and I think this should be bound to the TPM because that's kind of the only thing how we can do this securely. Another goal was this is confidential computing. Confidential computing, nobody knows what precisely it actually really is, and in particular what it's going to be in 5 years. But there are certainly some things where we probably should be ready so that if confidential computing actually turns out to be a thing, we behave in a way that you can tie the disk encryption again and the state of the confidential VM to against each other. Also, one of the goals with what I'm talking about here is really that other components can also do TPMs to stuff, meaning that a policy that locks secrets to the system state and to the OS is not something that should be exclusive to disk encryption, to the credentials management. I think probably all components of the system might want to include access policies to TPM bound secrets related to that. The goal is certainly to democratize these kind of things, not to own them, so that everyone can participate in this and make use of this. And the overarching goal, of course, is I want this good enough that this can be the default. I mean, I have no illusions it will take ages until, like, particularly the slower moving distributions will adopt this, but at least we want it to be so good that, the faster moving ones, let's say Fedora, could turn this on by default, and it will not break everything. This is, of course, a difficult goal, right? Like, it's certainly one achievable because Windows does this, right? Like, on regular consumer PCs, Windows does all the measured TPM stuff and things like that. So it's certainly not out of reach for us to do the same. But it's still not easy because unless we do exactly the same thing as Windows does, there's a good chance we'll run into hardware bugs and things like that. So, like, first, I would like to talk a little bit about the current state of all of this, specifically in systemd, but also in some other components, what we have in this area. But before we do this, any questions at this point? No question at this point. Okay, then let's jump right in. So the first component I'd like to talk about is systemd crypt setup. Crypt setup without the systemd prefix is, of course, has been a Linux component since forever, and it's how you set up disk encryption, like how you format a Lux disk, basically. Systemd crypt setup is just that, but it integrates the disk encryption with various areas. It can ask for passwords, can do TPM, FIDO2, PKCS11, a couple of other things. I want to talk about the TPM support. With systemd crypt setup, you can bind your Lux volumes to TPM2. There are three kinds of policies. Like, one is about literal PCR values. Do I need to repeat what PCRs are? I hope that everybody here was in the earlier talk, so I'm not going to do that. That's good. It saves some time. So the policies, how this, the secret to unlock the disk is released from the TPM. The primary policy is against PCR values, literal ones, or the signature of PCR values. This is like what I'm actually advertising what people use because it's less prone to like this brittleness problems with PCRs because it basically allows us to lock our disk against a signature. I talked about this in the earlier talk a lot, actually. So this is actually, I think, way more interesting than the literal PCR stuff. There is a policy available that you also combine that with a PIN, and the PIN checking is also enforced by the TPM. System crypt setup cannot just use the TPM stuff for unlocking, but it can also measure what it has unlocked specifically, and this is enabled on your folder if you use UKIs for the root file system. Then it will measure something that it derives from the volume key into PCR for 15 once it unlocked. Why do we do this? This, I think, is quite a powerful concept because, in a way, the volume key of the root file system is a little bit like an identifier for the system, right? Like, it's a key that hopefully was generated locally only on that machine, never leaves the machine. And hence, if we derive some ID from that and measure it into PCR, we can do fun things like, for example, we can prepare a disk image that is encrypted and comes with a TPM PCR policy against PCR 15. And that basically then means it can be unlocked only on that specific machine, and nobody by nothing else. There's also the other side of the equation is systemd crypt and roll. Crypt setup sets up the volume, systemd crypt and roll enrolls the things. It's kind of the other side. There's not much to talk about because it's just how you set things up, and everything that systemd crypt setup can set up, systemd crypt and roll can enroll. Next thing I would like to talk about is systemd PCR phase, a relatively recent addition. What this is about is most of the PCR measurements that happen on your system are usually boot stuff, right? Like where every component of the boot measures the next boot. Systemd PCR phase then continues this in user space. It's a tiny tool. All it does is that it's invoked at certain parts of the boot process and measures another string into PCR 11. So the purpose of this basically is that we can distinguish the phase of the boot. These four strings are, did I put it in? Yeah, enter initrd, leave initrd, sysinit ready, and shutdown and final. Why is this interesting? This is basically interesting so that I can write, put together TPM policies to secure objects that are locked to a certain phase or a set of certain phases of the boot processes, of the boot process. So basically, I can say the root file system, I can unlock it only during boot, right, and not afterwards. This is a really nice security property, because it basically means, if somebody exploits your system, I mean, they might still get the volume key from the kernel, but at least they cannot ever get it from the TPM again until there's a reset and they get back into this boot phase. It's some people call this capping of PCRs, but this is more generic, because it's not just a one-time cap of the PCRs. It's like it allows you to communicate clearly the state the system is currently in, and then you can use that for any kind of policy you want. Yeah, I already mentioned that it binds unlocking to certain specific phases of the boot processes. So that, yeah, once you, for example, transition from the energy to the host, yeah, all the keys are inaccessible. Next thing is systemvpcr machine. It's another component. Actually, it's implemented in the same C file as systemvpcr phase, because it does something equally trivial. All it does, it measures etc machine ID. Into PCR 15. So the etc machine ID, for those who don't know, is like, it's supposed to be an identifier for the system. It's written on first boot and supposed to be different, like as a UUID ultimately, that is different for each system. And lots of software derives things from that and recognize the system as that. So we measure that too. That basically means that I already mentioned that we measure the root FS volume key. And this together basically makes up the identity then of the system. So if you change either of those, the PCR measurements will change, and hence the identity of the system in a way changes.
Quick question. It is very common on cloud for customers to want to put together a virtual machine and then clone it. Have we found any way to solve the machine ID problem in that case?
There is a certain company called AWS. You might know them, and there are certain people who started projects there, including your colleague Alex. And there is this concept of generation ID that we all agreed on, and people started like implementing this, and then this was derailed on LKML, but ask your friend Alex. So from our side, everything's good. We know what we want to do, but we need to hook it into something that, if you have the generation, the VM gen ID thingy, that we can actually get that from user space, ideally race freely, and then can derive an ID. And then basically the idea would be that it's a machine ID plus the generation. But I don't know exactly what that actually means for the TPM case then. Should we measure that and then PCR 15 gets different? It's like certain things about generations of systems, like in the clone case, or as we talked in the earlier case about the soft reboot case, are not clear to me what the effects on TPMs are. Like how do TPMs progress? Should they change? Or should they stay the same? Like, yeah. Anyway. There are certainly things that make sense to measure, but I mean, my assumption would always be that if you like the binding to the specific TPM is kind of implicit usually if you generate the key on the TPM and it gets derived from the C. So if we manage like do that, I don't know. There's certainly like with all these keys, like even we probably need more infrastructure during boot that we can authenticate a TPM from our side, and maybe when we do that, we probably also want to measure that. But it's kind of like you get some data from the TPM and they give it back to the TPM to measure it. It's kind of pointless exercise in a way. You just open it up to being changed on the wire or something like that. I don't know. I long story short, I don't understand the implications of this. So I'm not opposed. But it certainly makes sense to measure more stuff into that PCR 15 But basically, I want PCR 15 to be understood as this is the identity of the system, and anything that is kind of unique to the system, and where if any of these components are changed, it should be considered a different system, probably makes sense to measure into it.
Okay, cool.
Another question, somebody? Okay.
Okay, so the next component is systemdpcrfs. It's actually also the same C binary because it's also just a trivial thing. What it does basically, it's an instantiated service, and it's instantiated for any file system that you want, including the root file system, and it just measures the UUID of the root file system basically, and a couple of other things that should not change between boots. So it also is measured into PCR15. Why do we measure both all three of the machine ID, the FS thing, and the encryption key? That's simply because we want to be somewhat stable against different definitions of what a machine is. Like, some people might use disk encryption, other people might not. Of course, you have much weaker protections if you don't use disk encryption, but that still implies if we want to be generic and systemd has to be somewhat generic, then we cannot only rely on the disk encryption key as the identifier. And similar for the other things, like some people use machine IDs that are transient or things like this, or use generations and ultimately, by measuring all three of these things, I think we can cover ground that there's always something there. And of course, if you don't bind it to the disk encryption key, it's kind of a weak thing, but that's on you, I would say. Yeah, so this allows PCR15 allows binding, unlocking resources to the identity of the local system. Next thing I want to talk about is systemd stub. I talked about this a lot in the UKI talk, so I'm going to go briefly over this. Yeah, it can do TPM2 measurements of the components of the UKI for you. If you combine it like this, then that's what we call a UKI. It measures primarily into PCR11, the components of the PCR, and measures a kernel command line that you pass in Secubit, it will actually refuse taking a kernel command line from you under the assumption that the one that's actually baked into the UKI is the one that matters. But if you turn off Secubit, it actually changes the logic so that it allows you to configure whatever you want on the kernel command line. And in that case, we'll measure it to PCR 12 so that there's always later security can still, you can do remote attestation or lock secrets to a specific kernel command line. If you change it, then you lose access and things like that. To summarize again what kind of measurements we do, PCR11 is the UKI and the boot phases. PCR15 is system identity, PCR12 is the kernel command line. Actually, there's more than that. This what we do, but I don't want to get lost into too many details. I already mentioned this in a UKI talk briefly. There's systemd measure, which generates the signatures for the PCR values so that you can protect disk encryption against a public key instead of literal values. So it pre-calculates PCR11 measurements basically before boot, taking the UKI component as input. And it signs the result, and then you can use it in systemd crit setup. It's supposed to be easy to use, meaning that if you have UKI, that uses this, like building a UKI like this is very easy because you just use UKIFI, which just wraps systemd measure. But once you build it and then you boot it up, then the signature and the public key is just there, and then systemd crypt and roll and systemd repart and whatever can format your disk will just take this into consideration given it's there and use it for the policy, so you don't actually have to do anything anymore. So the idea basically is like if you decide to accept UKIs as your savior, then all the other stuff comes basically for free. I also mentioned in the other talk UKIFI, which makes it easy to build these UKIs assign them and combine them. Next thing, systemd credentials. This is getting Let's do it like this. So, next thing, systemd credentials. I mentioned this a couple of times. Like it's how it can pass little bits of information into the system and then propagate them from the system into services. And you can also pass them from a hypervisor, like from outside of the hypervisor into the hypervisor to the system, and then also through container managers, and always propagate down the tree, basically. And these Christian credentials can be locked to TPM. So that it basically can say, yeah, I put my private key on the system and I lock it to the TPM, and then I know that when the service that needs it, it gets it, but if somebody takes it off the machine and somewhere else, they lose any chance to decode it. It's for secrets, certificates, cryptographic keys, passwords, whatever you have. Could also be used for configuration. We use it for configuration, but it's the key really is that it's not world readable. It's authenticated if you want and encrypted. There are multiple ways how you can pass your systemd credentials in there, like into a system, for example, via SMBIOS Type 11 objects. Not sure you heard about that. SMBIOS is this thing that, like, has been implemented on PCs for ages. It describes what kind of hardware and firmware the system has, but it has this Type 11 thing, which basically is vendor strings, and a couple of the virtualizers like QEMU and Cloud, how's it called? Cloud Hypervisor support this, that you can set this easily on the command line, and it basically allows you to give to the M in an extremely efficient way credentials or any other form of string, actually, and then the VMs can actually pick this up. It's how we actually suggest that all these kind of provisioning of systems should work, and I think that Cloud that's how they're called, and Ignition, these things should not exist, but this should be the way because it's blazingly fast and doesn't require networking and things like that. So we advertise that as the way. Of course, the big clouds don't support that, but we're working on convincing them otherwise. Anyway, so credentials can be supplied via SMBIOS, via some QEMU specific thing, via a kernel command line, via EFI system partition. This is basically required to securely configure boot and things like that, through a directory at secret store, and they're always inherited from there, from the system into services, based on, you can list basically one of these credentials has a name, and then you can list on a service which ones you want to import from the system into the service, and you have wildcards and a couple of other things so that you can do this generically. And they may be encrypted and authenticated with a symmetric key in the TPM. Policies are PCRs and signed PCRs, but no PIN, because these things are supposed to be non-interactive, right? Like the idea of credentials that they are unlocked the moment the service that consumes them starts, not earlier, not later. And service activation, of course, is something that's supposed to be non-interactive because that happens all the time. There's a tool called systemdcreds, which you can use to prepare these credentials, like to encrypt them and add authentication to them. And then you have this binary blob that you can use wherever you want. If you want to look into the details how this works, there's set credential, load credential, set credential encrypted, load credential encrypted, import credential. The latter is probably the one you actually want to use to configure on services. Look at the man pages for further details. The use case again is secure parameterization of systems and services, replacement for cloud and in clouds probably, but except for the case that none of the big clouds support this. OS installers can parameterize UKIs locally with this. This is in particularly relevant for the big commercial distributions, like let's say RHEL or something, because they typically run these installations where it's not under vendor control how they're parameterized, but under the admin who installed the system or something like this. And this opens the doors of doing this. Next thing I want to talk about is systemd repo. And by the way, still, anyone has any questions, totally interrupt me. Still, no one has questions. There's a question.
So in VMs, you mentioned SMBIOS 11 and QEMU. But on hardware, basically, your only option is then VFAT, EFI partition. Is that? Yeah. Okay.
If you have access to the file system, you can just put it in at secret store, of course. But if you basically want to provision a system offline without already setting up an encrypted disk or anything like this, I would. That's certainly a way to go.
Okay. Do you support
sysupdate for delivering credentials?
We do not.
Should we?
Maybe. Yeah.
I'm not volunteering.
So next thing I would like to talk about is system report. Sounds a little bit out of topic if you think about this first, because system report is a dynamic repartitioner of the system that is supposed to run on first boot. Actually, it was supposed to run on every boot and extend the partition table or grow partitions as necessary. So the original use case was, on the cloud, everybody ships like a tiny minimalized image, and then on first boot, it just expands and adds a couple of other partitions. So why do I put this on a slide in the DPM talk? That's because it actually can, one of the primary use cases for this is that on first boot, it actually creates a root file system, encrypts it, and links it against the TPM. So that basically, the idea is basically that you then ship a OS disk image which has the / user file system with the OS inside of it and uses DMVarity and is immutable and nicely protected. And then you boot it up for the first time, and this is when the root file system is added in. The / user partition is mounted into that. And the encryption key for that root file system is inherently local to the system. It's generated on the system. It never leaves the system and is locked against the TPM on that local system. It is quite frankly how I think this just should work, right? Like there are other approaches thinkable. I know, for example, at my former employer, they were big on re-encryption, right? Like, so that you shipped an encrypted disk and then on first boot, it would change the key. And I think it's a terrible idea because you waste a lot of resources with every IO, like every sector and things like that. Anyway, system repart is definitely something you should keep in mind if you build TPM-based systems, because something like this you probably do need in one form or another. And it's supposed to just work, right? Like basically that if you say encrypt equals TPM in a repart partition definition file, then and it sees that that partition doesn't exist yet, it would create it, format it with Lux, enroll it to the TPM, and you continue booting. System repart is declarative, non-destructive, automatic partition tool. It can create root or /var partitions on first boot and grow them too. And these partitions can be locked against a locally generated volume key. That's basically what I just said. Next thing, there's a question.
Do I understand you correctly that the system is encrypted at the first boot when the root file system is created?
Yeah, that's the idea, yeah.
Okay, so the system automatically also creates a passphrase to encrypt the disk.
Yeah, that's the idea, yeah. It creates a volume key randomly that never leaves the system and then enrolls the disk with that.
Okay.
Locks the key to the TPM.
But what happens, for example, when a user wants to install a custom kernel and now wants to boot the system, the TPM isn't unlocked because it isn't the kernel that was signed, and now he wants to unlock his disk, but the encryption key was created automatically. How could he do that?
If you manage to unlock the disk, you manage to unlock the disk. Right, so you certainly have access to the volume key then, and Linux in the kernel will always keep the volume key around for you because it needs it for decryption and encryption of the individual sectors. So what you could always do if you want to change the policy that you lock the disk to, you can always enroll the TPM again with different parameters. Lux has this model that you have slots, and then you can basically enroll a FIDO2 device, another FIDO2 device, 3 TPMs, 5 passwords, and 7 PKCS11 smart cards or whatever you want. So basically, yeah. System decrypt and roll even allows you to do this to some degree at least.
But don't you need to input the current password before you are allowed to add a new credential in Lux?
Well, yes, but if you manage to unlock it once, you can still unlock it, right? Like, if you ever manage to boot, if you cannot unlock the disk at all, right? Sorry. Then you're off, but if you manage to boot up with it, then the Linux kernel got the key. And if you didn't make use of the phase feature, right, like which basically locks unlocking of TPM to a certain part of the boot, if you didn't use it, then you can also, during normal runtime, unlock it in the same way, because the PCRs will still match. So, but yeah, of course, I mean, the if you use the PCR phase thing and you say, never unlocks this afterwards, then of course you're fucked. Like, because there's only this tiny window at boot where you can get the key, and if the kernel then has it and never gives it back to you, you can't get it from the TPA anymore. But this is up to you with what kind of policy you choose for this kind of lockdown.
Do you also support DM integrity in addition to DM crypts, so for authenticated encryption?
That's a very good question. Do we?
like, I mean, especially for data partitions like VAR, it would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, of course, everybody should use encryption and authentication for things like that. We certainly support it for, like, I mean, the libcrypt setup supports it. I'm not sure if we hope that through ever, but...
We have DM systemd integrity setup.
Sure, but I mean, we don't support
it. It's not integrating into this stuff, though.
Yeah,
I don't think so.
I don't think System Repair has the option for that, but adding that would be trivial, right? Like, we should just do it.
So thanks for volunteering, gentlemen. More questions? He likes questions. Ask questions. No?
So something that I very recently added, which is in the Git main, but it's not in in a release version yet, is that we actually maintain a TPM measurement log. So if you do measurements, it's kind of important that you also keep a log about what you measured so that you can argue about it afterwards and you can figure out what actually happened that you came to the point where you came to. The firmware maintains one measurement log that covers all the measurements that happened basically until the West takes over. It's available on Linux in /this somewhere, and you can parse it and then decide, okay, what's happening there, and then argue about what happened and everything's in order. It's actually a crucial part of deriving policy from an existing system that you don't know, where you don't know ahead of time the firmware measurements that would take place. We nowadays do all these measurements in user space too. Like, for example, measure the root encryption, like the encryption key of the root file system, and these phases and things like that. Previously, we never actually logged about that, so it made it very hard to argue about it, to do remote attestation, to figure out if everything's in order. I recently added this, that this is like improved. We did log it to the journal. Meaning to syslog kind of stuff, but that's kind of shitty because that's subject to rotation, of course. And if you want to come back like 1 week later and argue about PCR measurements, it kind of sucks if the beginning of your measurement log's gone, because then everything's invalidated. So that's why it needs to be separate from the journal. It can only grow. It can never be rotated away unless you're fine with losing the ability to argue about it. So this stuff is actually a format. It's a JSON file, basically. It's actually JSON sec, like JSON SEQ. It's a sequence of JSON objects. It's very close to the TCG CL JSON format. CL is the common event log format. It's not exactly that for reasons. I wanted to use that, but the CL is, you know, it requires that the logs, like, first of all, they have to have record numbers, right? Like, they always have to start at one and things like that. And I think that's a stupid idea. Like, first of all, it's redundant because you can just go to through the measurements and you don't need this information, and it's unprotected because it's not included in the hash. And because, I mean, to get the full list of measurements, you always need to include the measurements that the that the firmware did. And hence, if you maintain a log in user space and then add record numbers to it, what's this good for? Because it's going to add, like, what you label as one might actually be the 55th measurement in the whole system. So anyway, I left that part out. And the other thing that I didn't do is the TCG specification says it needs to be in a JSON array. And I think that's stupid, because it basically means that the log file wouldn't be append only anymore, because you basically have to load the whole array into memory, append one thing and write it back again, which is just shitty if it's supposed to grow. So I just opted for JSON SEQ, which is another RFC where basically you just add one JSON object, another JSON object, and you put a separator in between, which is like the ASCII code 17 or something, like record separator ASCII, and a zero, like a null at the end, and then Yeah, but it's trivial to convert it to the full spec, right? Like you just like and JQ and these tools, they all support this thing anyway. So it's trivial to convert. You just load all the objects and wrap them in an array, and you add the record numbers. There you go. They have the full thing. It's on purpose TCGCL so that other people can consume it, right? Like, so if you now take the logs that the firmware does, our logs, and then the IMA logs, then you basically have all the measurements that happen on the system. I think there's a talk right after mine talking about the universal event log stuff, so yeah. Let's not talk for that anymore. I think I got less than 10 minutes left. Any questions at this point in time?
5 minutes.
Otherwise, I'll talk a little bit about the shortcomings of the design, because this is far from complete. Like, one of the major things security holds in this system is that we measure all kind of stuff to PCR 11, 12, 15, but there is no anchor to it, right? Like, we assume that it's zero, and that's what we rely on, but because shim or no earlier boot thing measures anything about the chosen boot path into these PCRs, what people could do is they get their stuff signed by some shim key, then measure whatever they like in there, and not actually boot that, but boot something completely different, and they will get to the same PCR values and fuck with us. Solution one could be that shim, like this is a proposal, right, would measure into all these other OS PCRs, basically, some string identifying what they're actually going to boot, right? Like, so on, like, if it's a Fedora installation, they should just measure the string Fedora into it. That would have the effect, and if this is required by the shim signing process, that would already be enough to just make sure that, yeah, if a different OS will measure a different thing, then it wouldn't work anymore. Solution number two is something called system PCR lock. That I could probably do a talk about of its own. Let's talk about shortcomings number two. Asymmetric unlocking, this is something I want right now. If you enroll your disk against TPM, it's symmetric. You can only enroll it on the local thing, with some exceptions. We have something there now. Sometimes for a certain use case, it might be interesting to enroll a disk or a credential offline, like you do it on one system, and then the only that right system can unlock it. We are like we have some support for something like this in some scenarios, like confidential computing, but it's not there where I want it to be. There's no rollback protection, meaning that if you have a UKI that is probably signed with PCRs and things like that, and you have one from 5 years earlier where the kernel was vulnerable, both of them will get access to all secrets. There's no way how to invalidate the old kernels so far. Solution to that is also this component that I'm probably not going to talk about that much anymore because I don't have that much time, but it's something coming up to systemd very soon that will solve this. Biggest thing ever, like there's no way to lock against zero, like the other PCRs that basically lock down the firmware. Solution to that is also the systemd PCR lock. Next thing is, I don't know, or actually I have a rough idea now what KEXEC means with all of this, right? Like KEXEC is a thing where you replace one OS with the next one and pass control over to it. What does that actually mean for a TPM? Do you measure things new? I think I have a solution for that. Oh, it's again systemd PCR lock. So let's very briefly, I got like a minute or something, 2 minutes about systemd PCR lock. It's halfway there. I mean, there's a branch and you can play around with it, but it's not ready yet. It's not even Git main or anything. But this is the next thing that I have been working on for the last weeks, and I'm very close to having something ready for that. It's basically, I mean, some distributions like Ubuntu people, for example, have implemented something similar, but I think my solution is way more generic and is what people ultimately should use. What this does basically, it creates an access policy based on PCRs and tries to predict the PCRs based on what components you've installed in the system. Really short summary is that all the components that are involved in boot are supposed to drop in a file describing the measurements that are probably going to be made if that thing is booted, a so-called PCR log file, .PCR log. And they drop it in one directory, and they can drop in multiple alternative versions in case they want to support alternative versions of that component, like, for example, multiple versions of a kernel UKI, or multiple versions of the bootloader, multiple versions of shim, whatever you have in the boot process. And then system PCR log will look at this, will compare it with the measurements that actually happened on the system on the current boot, and if it recognizes everything, then we'll synthesize a access policy from that, stores that in an NV index, which is something you can do in TPM2 that not many people know, and then you can lock your disk encryption to that. Meaning basically that, and you can also generate these PCR log files directly from the log if you want to cover for firmwares where you do not know what kind of measurements they will make. Hopefully though, eventually these PCR log files, which by the way are just CL JSON files, because you can just reuse the format there because that's simply what measurements, like it just encodes what measurements happen. My long-term goal, of course, is that I want this eventually to be shipped with like the what's it called, LVFS stuff, like the Linux for, like, so FW update D basically can provide us with that information at the same time as a BIOS update, like as a firmware update happens, that nice vendors give us the measurements that are likely going to happen if that a boot happens. So anyway, this is the summary. You all read it now. My time's over. It's good that I didn't spend too much time on this because it's a talk of the future. And if you want to know more about that, you can look at the slides, or you can look at the PR that is, I've posted already, mostly to get CI testing and things like that. I'm still shifting a couple of things around there. But the ultimate goal of this, of course, is that we can do the same thing that Windows does and lock against the firmware, but still have a strategy what to do on expected firmware upgrades. In the nice case, when we know the measurements that will happen, and probably in the common case, where we will not know that and have to find out ourselves on the next boot what actually changed, so that we can subsequently lock it down again. Maybe we have a question.
We can take a couple of questions if there are questions. Any questions?
Questions? Yes.
I'm just wondering exactly what your idea is. Say you have a system set up with full disk encryption, locked to the PCRs, and locked to the specific UKR that's booted, right? How do you actually update this UKR? Say a new kernel comes out. How do you securely verify this is a kernel update that I want, while still preventing some bad actor injecting its own malicious code into signing? Like, how do you protect the signing key from everyone else?
You don't actually have to do anything special. You just take the UKI that is packaged in the RPM and drop it in the ESP. Because if the system then boots with that, it will come with the signature for the PCRs that are expected, and the signature will be done by the vendor. And only the vendor can do these signatures. So basically, you don't have to do anything special. It's just that the vendor has to prepare the kernels and include the right signatures so that it can still unlock your data.
Okay, but say you roll your own keys, then...
Sorry?
If you roll your own keys, right?
So if you do your own keys, then you have to sign locally. We have infrastructure for that. I mentioned that in the other talk, this Yukify kernel install script that can run basically whenever you install a raw kernel, like not a UKI kernel, but like an unsigned kernel, and then you can sign it automatically on install with your own private key. But then, yeah, sure, you have to make sure that you retain access to that key and you use the same key for every signing, because that's what will give you back access to your own disk.
Yeah, my question is whether you store this key.
That's up to you. You can store that on disk if you like. There's currently no support for something like OpenSSL 3 engines or something. But if we had that, and I think Luca volunteered to do this, then you can store that key on your, I don't know, PKCS11, HSM, YubiKey, whatever thingy. That's entirely up to
so
you.
So key
then.
Management is out of scope. Use one of these for the key. And yes, let's all thank Leonard for his talk.